This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The U.S. Department of Defense is one of the largest organizations in the world. It executes a budget more than twice that of the world's largest corporation, has more personnel than the populations of a third of the world's countries. The size and complexity of the department's finances and operations, along with the rapid pace of change, engagement of major military campaigns, and the worldwide economic uncertainty make it an imperative that DOD create a more agile, responsive, and efficient operation. Doing this will provide the best support and services for troops in the field, their families at home, and enable the department to be responsible stewards of the nation's resources. How is DOD improving financial information and audit readiness? What is DOD doing to improve its operations, become more efficient, and control costs? And what is DOD doing to promote management and organizational excellence? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller within the U.S. Department of Defense. Welcome, Bob.
Glad to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is John Bonklis.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here also.
Bob, before we delve into specific initiatives, perhaps you could give us an overview of the history and mission of your office.
Okay, I'd be glad to. Our overall mission is to be the principal financial advisor to the Secretary of Defense, and my office coordinates my efforts to do that. That includes formulating budgets, includes working with the Congress to be sure those budgets are enacted as best we can, and then executing the budgets. Obviously, many people in the Department of Defense participate in those tasks, but we have the overall responsibility for helping the Secretary do it. You know, the history goes back as long as I can remember. I've been involved in and out of defense budgets for more than three decades, but I'm pretty sure my office probably goes back to formulation of the Department of Defense. I imagine there was a comptroller back in 1947.
As a follow-up, could you tell us about the specific areas under your purview, the size of the budget you actually steward, and how your efforts support the overall mission of the department?
I'll go with the facts first. This year, we will execute about $688 billion worth of budget authority of the taxpayers' money to maintain our national security. So we obligate $2 to $3 billion a day on average. It's a very sizable amount. The Department of Defense is, in many ways, more like a country. Our budget's about equal to the gross domestic product of the Netherlands. In terms of the specific things that I do, as I mentioned, we spend a lot of time formulating budgets. It's our way of putting together our priorities. Also need to put them together in a way that can convince the Congress and the public that we both need the resources and will spend them appropriately to maintain national security. And then we have a responsibility to make sure that we execute those budgets in a manner that's legal. And there are 8,000 pages in the DOD Financial Management Regulations, so there are lots of laws and regulations. That's effective. That we meet the needs of our warfighters. And finally, it's efficient for the sake of the taxpayers. And maybe particularly in these days, efficiency is very much on our minds. So all of those are part and parcel of my day-to-day responsibilities.
So I was wondering, is it fair to say, do you believe that the financial function in DOD is properly structured, both for internal and external conditions?
I think so, roughly. I mean, I'm sure there are changes that are being made and should be made, but I think basically it's structured correctly. And let me say why. The great majority of financial managers in the Department of Defense work for our commanders and managers in the field. There are about 68,000 people in the defense financial management community. Roughly 58,000 of them are civilian employees. The other 10,000 are military. and I'm going to guess 90% or more, work for our commanders and managers. And that's how it should be. They are the people out there actually doing the day-to-day tasks. They're the ones that need the advice and counsel to make sure that things are legal, effective, and efficient. A small percentage work in offices like mine that provide oversight. So, I think it's basically properly structured.
Thank you, Bob. Regarding your responsibilities and duties, what would you say are your top three challenges that you face in your position, and how are you addressing those challenges?
Well, certainly a key challenge is to make sure that we acquire the resources that we need to meet national security objectives and do that when we're dealing with a nation that is in an economic crisis. I mean, obviously, strong downward pressure on all federal spending, including defense spending, as we look for ways to reduce the deficit. And I think those of us at the Department of Defense, Secretary Panetta has said that we understand we need to be part of efforts to hold down the deficit. At the same time, it's a dangerous world. We're still in a shooting war in Afghanistan. We're completing the military mission in Iraq. We're supporting a NATO mission in Libya. There are other nations like Iran and North Korea that are of potential concern to us from a national security standpoint, and I could go on with the list. So I think a key challenge is striking that right balance, getting the resources we need, but understanding that we need to make every dollar count in order to hold down the deficit. Once we get the resources, we need to execute them, as I've said, in a manner that's effective. I think we do that pretty well. A bigger challenge, though, is how well we do at documenting how we've spent the money and presenting that information to the public. And in particular, we are one of the two federal agencies that has never had a clean opinion, accounting opinion on or audit opinion on its financial statements. And that's something we need to change. My new boss just issued a statement a day or so ago saying we are going to get clean audit opinions, and I fully support him. So we are working that issue. It is definitely a challenge. Now, the last one I'll mention is championing, working for a strong financial management workforce. We need to have those 68,000 people well-trained, and I think they generally are, but I believe we need to provide a better framework for that training, and so I'm in the process of putting in place a course-based certification program for defense financial managers that will specify, as we do now for the acquisition workforce, for each job a certain level, and for each level a certain amount of training and courses that we would ask that they complete before they pursue that position. So I'd say that the budget job, certainly a major challenge, auditability a major challenge, working to maintain a strong workforce also a challenge.
Could you describe, if you'd like, please, your career path? How did you begin your career, and what do you bring in your current leadership role?
Well, I think a fair amount of diversity in my career. I started out after college and joined the United States Navy. I'm dating myself here, but it was the height of the Vietnam War when I graduated from Stanford in 1968. So I joined the Navy about a year later, spent a little more than 2 years as a Navy officer, and then about 5 years in the Selected or Drilling Reserves. I moved from that to a civilian position with a consulting firm, the Center for Naval Analyses. But the next big jump for me was to go to work for Congress as a staff person in the Congressional Budget Office, now a well-known organization in Washington, but at that time brand new. And I spent 12 years heading the Defense Program Analysis Group within the Congressional Budget Office, and it gave me an opportunity to see and work with members of Congress and their staffs. From there, I went to the Department of the Air Force, actually, as the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Financial Management and Comptroller, spent 7 years. After I left there, at a lot of time in government, I got a chance to head a professional society, the American Society of Military Comptrollers. I was their executive director. And that gave me an opportunity to see more of the people side of this business, the importance of training and professional development. And following that job, I took this one as the Comptroller and Chief Financial Officer of the Department of Defense. So I've been working in and around government for more than three decades, and much of it in and around the defense budget.
Well, with that experience, I was wondering if you could tell us, in your mind, what are the characteristics of an effective leader? And more particularly, who has influenced your leadership style and management approach?
Well, I think what I'll say is probably classic MBA stuff. I think an effective leader is one who first can articulate a vision of where he wants his or her organization to go. And the vision thing is important and not easy to do. I remember somebody saying to me once, if you don't have a vision and a list of associated tasks that are significantly more than you can do, then you're not stretching yourself. So I think establishing a vision is key. But it's not good enough to just say where you want to go. You need to provide the resources, both in terms of people and dollars, to work to accomplish that vision, and provide the motivation to those who will make that vision a reality for you. And finally, I think an effective leader is one who has a sense of how to measure progress and not do it in a way that's stifling to people who work for him or for her, but also measures how well you're doing so you can make changes as you almost have to do in approaches to achieving your vision. So it's sort of a vision, resources, and measurement. No one person has influenced me, but I've learned a lot from my former boss, Secretary Gates, who just recently left the Department of Defense. Brilliant man, strong manager. I think I'm going to learn a lot from my current boss, too. He's new to the Department of Defense, but he's got political skills that I think will serve us well and that I will be able to learn from, and many others throughout my career.
How is DoD improving financial information and achieving audit readiness? We will ask Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What are the seven management imperatives all government executives need to know? How is DoD improving its business operations? What is FAA's next generation air transportation system, or NextJet? How is New York City shaping a government that is customer focused, innovative, and more efficient? And what about power, security, and leadership in the 21st century? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense. Also joining us today from IBM is John Bongelis. Bob, with the National Defense Authorization Act of 2010, Congress established a deadline for DoD to achieve audit readiness by the end of fiscal year 17. Would you elaborate on DoD's financial improvement audit readiness strategy, its incremental wave approach? How does this strategy set the course for improving accuracy, reliability, and timeliness of information?
Well, I'd be glad to. Let me start by saying I believe the Department of Defense has reasonable controls over its budgets. There are some of our critics who assert the contrary. I think they're wrong. As evidence of that, I'd just note quickly that we have 3,000 auditors who are watching our program and financial moves, and yet we have quite high levels of compliance with key financial legislation, quite high levels of proper payments. But we do need to achieve auditable financial statements for a variety of reasons. They'll help us clean up some imperfections that we may talk about more in our business processes. But most importantly, they'll reassure the public that we're reasonable stewards of their money. And if I can, I'll tell you a quick story. I was early in my tenure with the Air Force, and I was talking to my wife about auditable financial statements, which we didn't have, and the Air Force still doesn't. I'm trying to explain it to her. She's not an accountant, so she asked me what they were, and I explained it. And I started talking, and she stopped me, and she said, "Well, Bob, if you don't have auditable financial statements, how do you know they're not stealing from you?" And I started to explain that financial statements or audits aren't designed to detect fraud, really. And then I just stopped and realized we'll never convince the public we're good stewards of their funds without doing it. So it's important to do it. And in terms – when I came into this job, there had been progress made, no question. But I think I quickly realized the department wasn't heading in a single direction. Services were doing different things. Some were doing more, some less, no common purpose. We were sometimes trying to do things where there wasn't much management commitment to doing it. So we formulated, I call it the focused approach. It basically pretty simple. It says let's put our highest priorities on improving information and achieving audit readiness for the kinds of information we most use to manage the Pentagon. And that's first and foremost budgetary information, because we manage the department based on budgets. And second, where our assets are and how many we have, which is very important to warfighters. Auditors call it existence and completeness. So we have focused our attention on trying to improve information in for those categories and move toward audit readiness, and at the same time formulated a cost-effective approach for the rest of the audit. But the wave approach, the early waves, are this focus on budgetary and asset count and condition information.
Actually, I would like to explore that even more. What are the benefits of focusing on these initial areas, and how critical are they to achieving audible financial statements?
Well, they're absolutely critical to achieving. You can't do it without it. Now, there are other things you'd have to do as well to have full auditability, but they are absolutely critical. I think the main – well, the two main benefits. First, it holds down the cost because you're focusing your efforts. And frankly, there's just so much that the department can do both financially and otherwise while we're fighting a shooting war and getting out, finishing the mission in Iraq. There's a lot of other things going on. So it focuses our efforts and sets priorities in a way that's healthy. Also, I think it has brought the department together in the sense that everybody accepts that we need budgetary information, including our military and most senior civilian leaders. So I think there's more support for this focused approach than there was some of the others that we have pursued in the past. So I think it is the right way to approach the problem. It's not a panacea. There's still a lot of hard work to go, but I think it's the right focus.
Bob, thank you. If I understand correctly, DOD obligates an average of $2 to $3 billion with a B dollars every business day and handles hundreds of thousands of payment transactions. Given this scale of operations, what are some of the major challenges and obstacles facing DOD in its efforts to improve financial information and audit readiness?
Well, John, you stated one of them in the question, which is our size and our geographical dispersion. What they mean is that we can't go hire an army of accountants, or it would be such a large army that we could never afford it, and do all this work manually. And that brings me to two other major challenges or impediments, if you will, that we face. First, our systems, our financial systems, many of them are old. Some of them date back to the 70s and 80s, and they aren't designed to do what auditors expect. They're designed to keep track of budgets. They're not designed to accommodate audits. I'll just give you one fairly simple example. If an auditor wants to see for each entry in the financial statements, for each payment at least, they want to see an invoice, somebody billing you for it. They want to see a receiving report, which means you got the stuff, and they want to see a contract that matches the invoice in appropriate ways. We have that information, but it's not automatically available. So when an auditor pulls a sample of thousands of payments spread all around the world, we have to go chase down the paper, and it's a task that you can't do quickly, and it's very expensive. The new systems that we're putting in will keep this information in an automated fashion, so it works well. We'll push a button, and when an auditor asks for it, it will be there. So we need new financial systems. The other thing we need are to improve our business processes. Well, I think we have reasonable controls. Our business processes are variable across our command, sometimes from base to base. They may be effective, but in some cases they're simply not something an auditor would accept. I'll give you two examples, one pretty simple. In one of the audits we're carrying out right now, we discovered that people were not bothering to delete names from the access list for financial systems. And sometimes that hadn't been done for years, and the auditors were rightly concerned that this is an internal control failing. That was pretty easy to fix. Harder is we do what's called bulk obligations of military personnel dollars. We manage military personnel dollars centrally because we manage the military personnel centrally, so it makes sense to manage the dollars. But all we have are these bulk obligations. The auditors want to see more detail where we put it, and so we're going to have to change that business practice in order to move toward auditability. So there are some major challenges that we've got to overcome. We're on our way, but it's going to be a lengthy journey.
Oh, thank you. The next one is a somewhat several questions in one question, but I don't think there'll be an argument anywhere that if someone would make the statement that to achieve and sustain auditable financial statements, DOD must improve its financial systems. Could you please tell us about some of the systems modernization efforts that you're pursuing, and how does the deployment of various ERPs across the department enhance DOD's capability to consistently record accurately the asset acquisition costs at the transaction level?
Okay, well, as you suggested, we are installing these enterprise resource planning systems, as we call them, ERPs, in all three of the services, three of the four services. The Marine Corps does have a system that at the moment we are not planning to replace, perhaps eventually, but not anytime soon. And we are also installing an enterprise resource planning system in most of the defense agencies, which themselves are large organizations. Installing these systems is a challenge. Installing any IT system is a challenge. There are the technical challenges, which tend to be relatively easier to overcome, especially after you've done it a few times. You know the system works. It's a matter of making it work at that particular place. I think the hard task is always change management. You install a new ERP in a commander base, you are asking somebody who perhaps has spent 20 years doing financial management a certain way to do it in a different way, and there is inevitably frustration and retraining required. I had a chance to visit some of the sites that are installing some of these new ERPs, and you could see the frustration on the faces and hear it in the voices of the people who were being asked to change. We've got to ask them to do it, but it's not easy. And unfortunately, it's not something that you do at one base and you're finished and you can export it easily to the next base. You got all the same problems because a new set of people. So change management is a major challenge with these ERPs, but I believe we're making progress. Blue Navy is farthest ahead, and it's got probably half of the Navy is on their new Navy ERP. Maybe not quite that, but they're coming up to it. The Army is moving out smartly, and I hope within a couple of years to have their new system deployed throughout the Army. The Air Force is getting started at one major base, but I think they'll pick up the pace. And we have several agencies, including one major defense agencies, on their new ERP. So we're making progress, but it will be a number of additional years and some sizable additional expenditures of funds before we finish.
Could you perhaps discuss or illustrate some of the highlights on some success stories given this effort for achieving audit readiness within the department?
Well, we have made some progress. The Army Corps of Engineers, which is actually not part of the DOD budget but still affiliated with the military, has fully auditable financial statements and is maintaining them, has for several years. Several of our large defense agencies have had auditable statements for sometimes more than a decade and have maintained them. The Defense Finance and Accounting Service, Defense Contract Audit Agency, Defense Commissary Agency, and some others. And some of our trust funds, we maintain some very large trust funds for military retirement and military health care, also have positive audit opinions. What we haven't done yet is achieve that goal for any of the military services, and that is by far the highest hurdle to leap. They are much more complex. They're bigger than anything we have gone after yet. But we have, for the first time ever, a statement of a military service, in this case the United States Marine Corps, under audit, their statement of budgetary resources. And I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll see a positive opinion this year, more optimistic that we'll make it by next year. So we're moving into what I might call the big boy issues of auditability in terms of actually working on the military services. And we just have to go after them before we're ever going to get close.
So, Bob, an effort like this, facilitating improving information and audit readiness, will require a governance structure. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the governance structure you have to ensure the success of your efforts. How have you learned from history?
I can. I think one important thing is somebody needs to be accountable and responsible, and in that case, it's the department's chief management officer, the deputy secretary, currently Secretary Lynn, although the White House nominated Ash Carter to be the next deputy secretary and next chief management officer. So the CMO is in charge, but the deputy has a wide variety of responsibilities, and so much of the day-to-day senior oversight falls to me as the chief financial officer, and also to our deputy chief management officer, Beth McGrath, who particularly focuses on the system issues, and I focus on many of the accounting and other audit issues. And we have an analogous structure in the services where their CMO, the undersecretaries in each military department, has overall responsibility, and their assistant secretaries for financial management and their deputy chief management officers kind of do the day-to-day oversight. And that structure carries on. We do a senior oversight meeting once a quarter. We do meetings with one level down monthly. So we have a structure in place for oversight of this process.
If not mistaken, under the current audit rules, it seems that meeting the 2017 date for audit readiness would have required the expenditure of large sums of dollars to acquire and improve information, especially valuation information, that arguably is rarely used by DOD managers. Would you kindly tell us more about your efforts to identify a feasible approach or set of valuation alternatives to achieving fully auditable statements that also conserve taxpayer dollars?
We recognize that this information is required for full auditability. We also recognize, as you suggested in the question, it is generally of low, sometimes very low value to department managers. And this is mostly assessing the historical costs of our weapons, our buildings, our large spare parts, and support equipment. In a private company, that would be very important information because they would depreciate that and use the depreciation to offset taxes. But I don't pay taxes at the Department of Defense. And they also need it to assess book value. Their stockholders want to see it. I don't have any stock. I'm not planning to sell the Pentagon. So it is of much lower value, I think, than it would be in the private sector. Nonetheless, we need to do it. We've tried to find a cost-effective approach. And that cost-effective approach is to focus first on the high-value information, in particular that statement of budgetary resources, the budget information. That feeds a lot of the data. If we get that to be auditable, it'll be a big step in the right direction. To get the enterprise resource planning systems installed, including the ones in the logistics area, because they'll be critical to the valuation of the things that keep track, for example, of all the spare parts. And finally, and we won't try to do the valuation efforts until those two tasks are completed. And when we do try, we will do it only prospectively. That is, we won't go back to try to figure out the value of a building that's 20 years old. We will only look at new buildings. Now, that means we're going to have to accept qualifications on our statements for some number of years. But I think that it's appropriate in terms of cost effectiveness. And finally, there's one area, and it's maybe close to half of our assets, the valuation of our military equipment. I mean, the historical value of a B-2 bomber, for example, that is a particularly low value. We are considering asking for a change in the accounting rules that would allow us to, it's called expensing, sort of write off the value year to year so you wouldn't have to audit it beyond auditing the budget data. So we've got a long ways to go there, but I think we have a cost-effective approach to achieving historical cost valuation.
Bob, you've done a wonderful job of explaining a very complicated situation that you're dealing with in terms of an initiative. But how are you getting the message out beyond the financial community to other stakeholders that understand about the efforts you're engaging in?
Well, I think we've only begun to do that. We've certainly used the classic mechanisms, speeches by senior leaders. There are some magazines, especially one run by my former organization, the American Society of Military Comptrollers. We've used that. But the way the word will really get out is when we start to do audits in the field, there will be then a strong incentive for people to learn more about this and find out why they're doing it. And I think we'll get more attention at that point. Also, I mentioned briefly a course-based certification program that I hope we will put in place that will require certain kinds of training at various levels of jobs. Audit training and some basic accounting will certainly be part of that course-based requirement. So we'll use that framework to increase awareness. You know, there's one thing I didn't mention, and if I could just go back, because I think it's particularly important part of our focus strategy. We have set this goal for 2017 to achieve auditable statements. But let's face it, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I got to get to work and work real hard to meet a goal in 2017. I think one of the mistakes the department has made is setting these very long-term goals and without enough interim goals to cause people to have a near-term focus. So we have tried hard to establish goals for this fiscal year and the next fiscal year that are reasonably aggressive. For example, we have, as I mentioned, the Marine Corps' budget statement under audit. We're doing a number of validations of particular parts of the financial statements that we know we need to make work. And these are due next month or 2 or 3 months from now or maybe a year from now. So I think I hope, at least, that people do wake up in the morning and think, I better get to work and get that done or the comptroller guy is going to be on my case. I think establishing near-term goals will show progress. Probably relieve the anxiety in the Congress, and I think it will be an incentive to our own people to actually see something happening in this area.
What is DOD doing to improve its operations, become more efficient, and control costs? We will ask Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is FAA's Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen? How is the U.S. Department of Homeland Security turning its one DHS vision into reality? What is New York City doing to shape a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and more efficient? And how is the DOD improving its business operations? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. We bring you insights and interviews from government executives who are changing the way government does business. Hear from FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, DHS Undersecretary for Management Raphael Boris, New York City Deputy Mayor for Operations Stephen Goldsmith, and Dave Winogrand, Assistant Deputy Chief Management Officer at DOD. Professor Joseph Nye and General Anthony Zinni on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century, and seven management imperatives that government leaders should pursue to be successful in an era of fiscal constraint. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense. Also joining us today from IBM is John Bongles. So, Bob, the level of effort associated with the auditability initiative seems significant. And resources being as tight as they are today, how are you properly resourcing these improvement and reform efforts?
Part of this focused approach I've spoken about with regard to our audit efforts was to get resources in our future years defense plan for each of the military services and also for our key defense agencies. And I think we've generally achieved that in the aggregate. We've budgeted more than $300 million a year across the entire Department of Defense for efforts to figure out where we have problems. Main effort would be to correct those problems, but also to pursue the audits themselves. So I think we do have the resources we need, and with the resources, we're gradually acquiring the staff, both mainly civilian and government employees, and also certainly some contractor employees. Because in this case, the contractor community has some special skills that we don't. So I think it is reasonably resourced at the moment. As we go through these period of lean budget times, we need to watch and be sure that those resources are sustained in a reasonable manner. I think right now we're in reasonable shape.
Bob, you mentioned in the last segment, you alluded to how commercial entities have audit opinions and how it may differ a little bit from what DOD is doing. We don't have stock. We're not selling anything. I'd like to maybe delve a little bit deeper into that. Would you elaborate on how DOD's efforts to achieve a clean audit opinion may differ from other commercial entities?
Well, first let me mention the ways in which they're the same. And I think audit efforts are designed to assure the public, in our case, and stockholders primarily in the case of a private company, that your financial statements are materially correct. And that word material is important. They don't have to be perfect, but they've got to tell the right story at a fairly high level of fidelity. That's true for the Department of Defense. That's true for a private company. The budget side of our house, probably analogous, both private companies and the public sector entities like DOD have the same responsibilities with regard to budget. It's the balance sheet where the value differs. We just have less need for valuation of our inventory and our buildings and our other assets than would be the case in a private company. Again, in a private company, they would use that to calculate depreciation and that would reduce their taxes. And so it is critical for them to have that information. And book value is important to a private company to assure their stockholders that they are a going concern and they're a viable concern. It just doesn't have the same importance in a public company. It's different, and therefore I think we need to approach it in a manner that reflects the value of the information, putting our resources on the highest value information, looking for cost-effective approaches for the information that is lower value to public managers.
Given the significant fiscal and economic pressures the country is facing, DOD leadership has embarked on a department-wide cost-cutting effort with a particular emphasis on business operations. Could you please tell us more about DOD's efforts to cut costs and realize savings, and what are some of the key initiatives being pursued within the department to achieve cost reduction?
Okay. I mean, we really began what I usually refer to as the Secretary's Reform Agenda in the fiscal 2010 budget, or the latest version of that agenda. And that was under the leadership of former Secretary Gates, an effort to look at systems that were either poorly performing and didn't look like they were going to recover quickly, or where, frankly, we had bought enough to meet our inventory needs. And so we ended procurement, for example, of the F-22 aircraft over the 2 years from 10 to 11, ended procurement of the C-17 transport aircraft. We terminated some poorly performing systems. We had a VH-71 presidential helicopter that was heading toward being $500 million per helicopter. We terminated that program, terminated some that seemed to have missions that were too narrowly focused or just were beyond what we needed at a minimum. So there were probably 20 mainly weapons programs that were terminated or restructured in fundamental ways in the Fiscal 10 and Fiscal 11 budgets. When we turn to the Fiscal 12 budget, which is the one we submitted last February, there are still some system changes there, but the focus was now on our business operations. We looked hard at whether we could just pursue better business practices. For example, we have literally thousands of data centers in the Department of Defense. We think we can achieve some substantial efficiencies by consolidating those data centers. I think it's a common issue across government, but we're big, and so there are a substantial potential for savings there. We think we can restructure some of our organizations in ways that save money. The major decision that was made was to disestablish the Joint Forces Command, set up about a decade ago to promote jointness in warfighting in the Department of Defense. That remains a very important goal, but the decision by the department is that we could sustain that jointness now without a separate command devoted mostly to that task. And we saved about $400 million a year by closing JFCOM, as it's called, Joint Forces Command. And there are a number of other reorganizations that are either underway or will get started. We did continue some system terminations, the Marine Corps' Expeditionary Fighting Vehicle, for example, the Army's SLAMRAM ground-to-air missile. And finally, we did some streamlining, just basically looking at lower priority tasks and saying, you know, times are tough. We'll just have to do with a little less. Army, for example, reduced some of its military construction funding, pushing out a bit its time frame that they will, on average, keep buildings. And activities like that, there were hundreds of examples, but I think those are illustrative of the changes that we made to try to achieve some substantial savings.
Bob, I'd like to switch to medical costs. Apparently, DOD's medical costs have skyrocketed in recent years from, I think, $19 billion in FY01 to more than $52 anticipated for FY12. Could you tell us how the department is seeking to slow the cost of medical care while not sacrificing its quality? What are some of the proposals you're pursuing?
Okay. I mean, and you put it right. Our goal is to continue high-quality care for our active duty personnel, their dependents, and our military retirees and their survivors, but to slow the growth in costs. And we will not reverse that growth given the overall growth in healthcare costs in the nation. Our goal is to slow it. For the last several years, we have pursued a number of efficiency issues in an effort to slow the growth in medical care costs. For example, we were able to achieve legislative authority to use the drug price scheme that the Veterans Administration employs or the pricing schedule that they employ, which will save us nearly $500 million a year. We are now using Medicare prospective payment rates for many of our outpatient activities, also achieving some substantial savings. We've looked, I mentioned contractor reductions. We have looked to reduce staff, particularly contractor staff, and what's called the TRICARE Management Agency that manages many of these dollars. So we're looking first and foremost to efficiencies. But we also recognize that we're going to have to make some changes in what we charge our beneficiaries for health care, particularly our retirees. And I'll pick just one example because we've made a legislative proposal, which so far has been well received this year in the Congress. There's a system called TRICARE Prime. It's a health maintenance organization that's used by many working age military retirees, working age being defined as under age 65. They pay right now $460 a year as an enrollment fee for this coverage, which is quite generous. Just by way of comparison, I have a federal employees program that It's generally similar to TRICARE Prime, and I think my fee is about $4,000 a year, and that's typical in the private sector. We have asked the Congress to let us increase those fees modestly from $460 a year to $520 a year, and then to index the fees to a medical care index beyond so that they keep pace with growth in the costs in the private sector. And so far, in general, Congress has approved. They did limit some of the indexing to the cost of living allowance, but they have approved our general concept. And we have a number of other programs, for example, some changes in our pharmacy copays designed to provide incentives to use generic drugs, which are much cheaper for us where they're medically appropriate, and also to use mail order, where, again, it's medically appropriate. Both of those actions would save us a fair amount of money, and we're trying to provide incentives for people to do it. So those are examples of the proposals that we are making that are working their way right now through the legislative process.
If history is any indicator, the wars fought are seldom the wars planned for. How do you effectively budget and plan given the strategic reality? And more importantly, is the current budget planning process viable, responsive to today's asymmetrical threats?
Well, your question reminds me of a statement my former boss, Secretary Gates, used to like to make, that we have a perfect record in forecasting future wars. We've never gotten it right. And I think he's right. I don't think too many people would have anticipated, say, maybe a year before 9/11, that we would have been fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan. It is a challenge to budget. That's a significant challenge. I think the biggest challenge is flexibility to move money around when you're involved in a shooting war as we are now in Afghanistan. If I were probably picking a single challenge that is greatest for me as comptroller, it would be achieving the flexibility that our warfighters need. I like to say we have an 18 to 24-month budget process, and it seems to me that people like General Allen, now the commander in Afghanistan, sometimes need 18 to 24-day turnaround. Not quite that bad, but we do have some mechanisms to achieve that flexibility. Congress does allow us to – does appropriate money in some pots of funding where we have flexibility. Pick one in particular, the so-called JIDO organization, the Joint Improvised Explosive Devices Defeat Organization, which funds efforts to detect and eliminate improvised explosive devices on the battlefield. JIDO gets a pot of money that's quite flexible, and we can, during the year, move it around in the ways that best meet the needs of warfighters. And there are a few other pots of money like that. The main way that we achieve flexibility is a process known as reprogramming, essentially an agreement with the Congress that we will go up there periodically and give them details on wanting to move money from pot A to pot B. It has to be zero sum. We don't get to add any funds, and it has to be legal, obviously, and they must approve. All four of our oversight committees have to approve, and in that case, we can, during the execution year, move money around. It's cumbersome. It takes a lot of effort on both sides of the river, both the Pentagon and the Congress. But it is our main way of meeting warfighter needs, and we use it all the time.
How has the department changed since your last tour in the building as the Assistant Secretary of the Air Force for Financial Management and Comptroller, SAF FM, under President Clinton? And how has it remained the same?
Well, I'll start with the same. The Department of Defense has a strong commitment to meeting national security needs. I mean, I think there is an esprit de corps, a feeling among the employees throughout the department, certainly including the Pentagon where I work, that this is an important mission. I think it means morale is generally high, not that it's perfect, but there is a sense that we're doing something important for the country. That hasn't changed. What has changed that's so noticeable to me are the two wars, or they have caused changes that are very noticeable to me. First, the pace of operations throughout the department is just at a more rapid pace than was the case in the 1990s. We had one fairly short war, the Kosovo War, during that period, but it was nothing like what we're doing now. Pace of operations faster. Financial management efforts more challenging. We have a whole much bigger budget now. We have a whole separate set of the budget called the Overseas Contingency Operations, or OCO. It pays for added wartime costs that has to be put together, and it's hard to put together and defended. So the wars have caused major differences. We work a lot more with the State Department than was the case, I think, in the 1990s. Not that we didn't work with them there, but they are daily partners in our efforts in Afghanistan, and we have frequent financial interactions with them. So it's a much different environment than it was. The same in some important ways, but different largely, I think, because of Iraq and Afghanistan.
What does the future hold for DoD financial management? We will ask Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Each edition of the Business of Government magazine has as its focus the core mission of the IBM Center, connecting research to practice as a means to improve public management. We do this by bringing together insights and perspectives blended with an equal measure of practicality and reflection from an array of government leaders, public managers, thinkers, and practitioners. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In an era of fiscal contraction, today's leaders face unique challenges that present many difficult choices. It is a period that, while imposing many constraints, simultaneously confers as many opportunities to make a difference, introduce new ways of managing, explore pragmatic approaches, and pursue management imperatives that help government leaders perform in an ever-challenging and complex environment. In our latest edition, we bring you conversations with FAA Administrator Randy Babbitt, outlining the Next Generation Air Transportation System, or NextGen. Rafael Boris, DHS Undersecretary for Management, discusses how the department is turning its one DHS vision into a reality. Stephen Goldsmith, Deputy Mayor for Operations for the City of New York, discusses how the city is shaping a government that is customer-focused, innovative, and efficient. We offer perspectives on power, security, and leadership in the 21st century from Professor Joseph S. Nye Jr. and General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command. Our forum presents seven management imperatives that government leaders must pursue to be successful in this new environment. All of this and so much more in the Spring-Summer 2011 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Download or order a free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense. Also joining us today from IBM is John Bongelis. So, Bob, I have the pleasure of talking to many of my guests about the use of collaboration and partnerships among agencies and the private sector to achieve mission results. How are you leveraging partnerships to improve management operations and program outcomes?
Well, that's a good question because let me turn to the private sector first, especially in this environment where we are trying to reduce in some cases our use of contractors. I think that we are at risk of sending the wrong message. The Department of Defense absolutely depends on the private sector to make national security work. We don't produce any weapons. They are produced for us entirely by the private sector. We need the special expertise. In my case, maybe it's audit expertise and others that we get from the private sector, but there are many other areas where we need the expertise. So if there are people listening out there that are in the private sector, I sure hope they don't take the wrong message away when we say that we are looking to cut back on growth or even the absolute numbers of contractors. We depend heavily on the private sector and will continue to do so. I think there's increasing partnership among agencies. I mentioned it briefly in the last section. A number of agencies are involved, but the State Department is most involved. They are our daily partners in war, and we need them very much. I'll give you an example. Our commanders in Afghanistan very much wanted to build, a specific example, a power plant in the Kandahar region of Afghanistan. This was a hearts and mind kind of activity. They felt that we could do something to help the Afghan people that the Taliban could not, and that it would set us apart in a way that they felt would help meet our national security objectives. It was a great idea, but fundamentally, the Department of Defense does not have the legal authority to build power plants. We tried to use some of our other authorities. Congress, I think, legitimately pointed out that we were stretching it. So we partnered with the Department of State, and I should have added, normally this might be done by the Agency for International Development, a part of the Department of State, but they felt they didn't have the capability to operate in a war zone, and they also, frankly, have a much smaller budget than ours, so they had more limited financial flexibility. We partnered with the Department of State, went jointly to the Congress, and said, we would like the authority, we call it the Afghan Infrastructure infrastructure fund to do things like the Kandahar power plant. We asked for $400 million this year for the Afghan infrastructure fund. And it'll be a dual key activity. That is, every project will be approved both by the Department of State and the Department of Defense. And then we'll work out who actually executes it. If aid can do it, that'd be great. If not, we'll use some of our combat construction people if that's more appropriate given the threats in the area. So I think that's an example of a major project, but there are many others where we are cooperating with the Department of State. We need them in order to maintain, in order to meet our mission objectives in Afghanistan, and we're close partners with them.
Thanks. Bob, turning just for a little bit here, our focus on the position of the CFO, and given the crucial and strategically important role financial information plays in mission and program delivery, how do you think that position of CFO has evolved to become more of a strategic business partner across the department? And if you could, please, what are some of the key characteristics of an effective CFO?
Well, I think it's fair that we are a business partner. You know, many people think the main job of a comptroller is to say no, and that is part of our job. There's a teasing phrase we use to describe our work that comptrollers aren't happy till you're not happy. But in fact, most of the time, if we're doing our job, yes, we may have to say, no, you can't do it that way, but hopefully if we're doing a job, we say, but you could do it this way. Or many times we can just say, yes, I can make that happen for you. So we are a partner in the sense that we can help organizations that have legitimate needs find resources, and I find people are appreciative of our efforts, and most of the time we can say yes, and it'd be my goal to say yes as often as I legally can do so. In terms of key characteristics for an effective public sector CFO, one thing I think is certainly knowledge. I can't imagine taking over being the CFO of one of the most complex and one of the largest organizations in the world without knowing something about the Department of Defense. I guess you could do it, but it would be tough. Certainly an effective CFO needs basic leadership skills. We talked about some of them before. In my view, vision, being able to bring resources to bear, some reasonable ability to measure how you're going and make corrections. And I think an effective CFO in the public sector needs some public sector savvy. Pretty different situation or requirements for a CFO in the private sector, where you're going to be very concerned about stocks and basic financing, and the public sector, where you're very concerned about working with the United States Congress because they're the branch of government, the only branch of government that can make funds available. So I think some understanding and experience with the public sector, with working with Congress, are critical to being an effective CFO in the government.
Bob, I think both of us would be in agreement here, and probably all three of us, that people are truly our most valuable asset, and that's not just a throwaway line. But given the DoD's absolute critical mission, your office requires staff with technical skills and expertise. So what are you doing to ensure that you have a well-trained and technical workforce able to meet both the challenges of today as well as the opportunities, let's say, of tomorrow?
Well, that is a major challenge, and you know, in the day-to-day working with budgets and going through some of the chaotic period, frankly, that we're going through as a nation in terms of our economic situation, it's easy to lose sight of the people that are working for me directly, which are a fairly small number, but also the 68,000 people that are working throughout the defense financial management workforce. But that's why I have one of my three major goals is to champion an effective financial management workforce. And I mentioned briefly earlier, I'll say a bit more about it now, what we're trying to do. First, I think this workforce that's out there now is generally well-trained. We have a lot of courses. We did a small thing early in my tenure here. We created a website that tried to catalog all the professional development courses available to financial managers through the U.S. government and allow it to be searched based on where the courses were given, how they were given, what level they were appropriate for, and gave a website address so that people wanted to pursue them more, trying to make it easier to find ways for professional development. But the effort we're embarking in now to establish a course-based certification program for defense financial managers, I think, is the fundamental one that I think will be of good use. Our financial workforce, in my view, is well trained. But what we don't have is a framework to provide them guidance on where they ought to be trained. Many of them get that through mentorship, and that's fine, and I hope it continues. But I would like a little more formal mechanism, and I would like to use that mechanism to require courses in critical areas. We've talked about audit. All our people need to understand why audits are important. They need some basic accounting training. Another area where I hope to use this framework to nudge this career field is toward a more analytic orientation. We're still pretty heavily oriented toward reports and producing them, and our managers need that, and I don't want to stop. But I hope as we install these new financial systems, they will make it easier to produce those reports. And there'll be more time to worry about how a manager makes changes, presenting options to him or her, assessing the value of those options, and then helping him carry out the decision, the analytic side of our business. And I hope you can train people to do that. I'm hoping to use this course-based certification to nudge people in that direction. So people are key. I try to keep that in mind. I'll just say early in my tenure as Air Force financial manager, a wise person, my principal deputy at the time, told me that your problem in this job, Bob, is the operating investment quotient, if you will, or ratio. You're going to be consumed by the day-to-day operations. You're going to need to get budgets out. You're going to need to work with Congress. You're going to need to answer the questions of the secretary. But you got to remember that when you walk out the door, that'll all go on. You want to spend some of your time making investments that actually make long-term changes. And I think the course-based certification is an example I would put in the investment criteria. And I try to devote some of my time to making sure that comes about. So too would auditable financial statements. I think people are important, and we're trying to take some steps to provide meaningful improvements in that area.
Bob, I'd like to turn to the future. If you will. What are some of the major opportunities and some challenges you think your organization will face in the future, and how do you anticipate evolving to meet those opportunities and challenges?
Well, some of them obviously will depend on national security requirements, which I don't think any of us can foresee very well. We mainly need to maintain flexibility in order to respond to what could be highly variable challenges in the future. Certainly, we're going to see technical evolution, probably greater and greater use of electronic media for communications. I entered the Navy in 1971, I believe. I was told that it was right around that year. I'm sorry, I entered the Navy in 1969. In the early 70s, the first email was sent by the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency. Think how much emails have changed our life. Something will come along. I'm not sure I know what it is. We've got to be prepared to take advantage of those changes. But I go back to the fundamentals. I think the biggest thing will be maintain and develop and motivate a workforce that can get this job done. And we've talked some about that. But I think it's probably the most important way in which we can accommodate the future.
What advice would you give someone who's thinking about a career in public service or the military?
Well, I'd do it. I have found it very satisfying. It's technically satisfying, at least in the Department of Defense and financial management. You're involved in financing one of the world's most complex and one of the world's largest organizations. There's a sense that you are meeting an important public need, which I find satisfying. But I think the biggest reason is something I'll call driving home satisfaction. And it doesn't happen every day, but there are times when I drive home from work thinking that I have done something that day to actually help the men and women who, as I speak, are putting their lives on the line to defend our freedom. And that makes me feel good. And I think you can find that kind of driving home satisfaction, not just in the Department of Defense, but in many other public sector jobs. So it's not for everyone, but I believe it can be very rewarding. And if you're thinking about it, I certainly hope you get a heavy thought and give it a try.
Well, Bob, I want to thank you for your time. But more importantly, John and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Well, thank you in return for the chance to be here. It's an honor to serve. It really is. It's an exciting and challenging time. And I appreciate the chance to spend a few minutes sharing my experience with you and your audience.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Robert Hale, Undersecretary of Defense and Comptroller at the U.S. Department of Defense. My co-host today from IBM has been John Vongelis. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What is the U.S. Department of Agriculture doing to transform rural America and enhance its prosperity? What is the USDA doing to cut costs and improve organizational performance? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with his very special guest, Kathleen Merrigan, Deputy Secretary at the U.S. Department of Agriculture, next week on the Business of Government Hour.